press the flesh, Pappy? Do a little politicking?
I'll press your flesh, you impudent son bitch. You don't tell your Pappy how to cut the electorate. We ain't one at a time in here. We're mass communicating.
Welcome to Agenda 31, everybody.
In a way that usually only war and fluoride can, war and fluoride can, war and fluoride can.
Because you can't have prosperity if you're constantly under the risk of a terrorist attack.
We're not policing the world. We're not policing the world. No, we don't have a military-industrial complex.
I agree that courthouses are special places in the nature of a church.
I think it's time that people do something for themselves and stop just taking whatever's handed to them.
You know, you're going to have to shut up or I'm going to have you arrested.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Agenda 31. This is your co-host, Todd McGreevy. I'm being joined by...
Corey Ibe.
Greetings, Corey, and in the morning to you.
In the morning to you, Todd.
Welcome to Agenda 31, the namesake of the website, agenda31.org. Today is Saturday, May 30th, 2015. This is episode 33. I forgot to name the episode number last time, Corey, so I hope people aren't confused when we're listening to that episode.
Not our listeners. They're not confused.
No, never. And we appreciate you tuning in. If you're tuning in live at the agenda31.org website, listen live in the upper right corner. You know, when we're not live and you click on that link, it actually is playing back these podcasts, playing back these broadcasts. I keep about the last two or three in the queue, and they just rotate continuously. So if you ever... You know, I would like to listen to Agenda 31, but I didn't subscribe to it. I can't remember where the link is. You know, I don't have iTunes. I don't subscribe on iTunes. You just go to agenda31.org, go to the upper right corner, say listen live, and you will hear the one of these podcasts being broadcast back. So that's always there for your enjoyment. And of course, agenda31.org is a riff off of the term Agenda 21, the global agenda to control property behavior, under the auspices of leaving this planet in a better place than we found it. Who can't be for that? Who doesn't want clean water? Who doesn't want clean air? Just let us government overlords control the assets and resources on your behalf because it's for your own good. So that's Agenda 21. Agenda 31 dares to ask the question, what is your strategy to make a difference in the county where you live? There are 3,100 plus counties across America. And if people would turn inward to their own county structures, their own county governments, their sheriffs in their county, and evaluate the circumstances in their own county, they can start affecting change from the bottom up rather than from the top down, which is what we're taught by culture and media. And I include the public disinformation systems of our so-called schools as part of that. So, Corey, speaking of the distractions, here in Iowa, where I live, I'm broadcasting from Scott County, Iowa. We get the rash of presidential wannabes coming through here constantly.
Yes.
Every 4 years, it is the cycle begins, and we...
Better Iowa than California.
Oh, geez. It just goes on and on.
I don't know why they pick on you guys every 4 years.
Oh, well, it's the reason is that we're the first in the nation, if you will, for the caucuses, for the party apparatchik to organize itself and to caucus and give essentially a straw poll result of who their preference is. New Hampshire's second, and I think it's North Carolina after that. And I could be mixing and matching primary voting right now. I think, no, the primary voting happens on the same day when there's a primary
election. Is there a reason why Iowa is first? Is there any?
It is. It's geographically center. So it creates a geographic, you know, relatively centered in America. It's also manageable from a media and populist standpoint. Only 3 million people in the state. So if you want to do your caucusing in New York State, you know, you got a lot of people to deal with. It's easy to get around. It's a very sought after status to be first in the nation.
I see. There's only 3 million people in Iowa. That's it.
That's it. There's probably 3 million people in your county where you are right now, Corey.
Yeah. Right now I'm broadcasting from LA County,
right.
But according to Google, which cites the United States Census Bureau, there's 3.1 million people in Orange County.
Right. That's how many
people... You can drive across Orange County in 20 minutes.
Wow. Yeah. It's very densely
populated.
Well,
not in today's real world with traffic, but yeah. If there was no traffic, you could drive across Orange County in 20 minutes.
So it's interesting to note the difference in our respective geographies. It's why I've been so impressed with what you've been up to, Corey, out in Orange County all these years that we've worked together. And that is, if you're able to keep the Superior Courts of Orange County and the County Sheriff's Office and the Irvine PD, among others, on their toes and accountable, because you've done it better than anybody I know. Granted, the results aren't exactly what you'd prefer, but at the same time, you're upright, breathing, and at least free enough to be on this podcast as
well. Well, that's true.
And as opposed to the guy who started the Silk Road the website that just got life in prison yesterday.
That's right. So I'm doing better than a guy that did a couple billion dollars in drug transactions. So
probably not a fair comparison. We should get to that. So back to the presidential preference and how we get all the wannabes marching through Iowa. I'm in the Quad Cities, and as you know, I've been on this local CBS affiliate Sunday morning talk show that's pre-recorded a few days earlier. Well, I was asked to be on again this week. At last minute, I think the other guest bailed out, and I was on but right after Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders came to town, and he's politicking around here. And so I was in the studio live, you know, got to meet him, shake his hand, say hello when he walked in. And then he proceeded to sit down and record a 20-minute interview with Jim Needleman, the host of this For the Record show on CBS4, WHBF here in the Quad Cities. Bernie is a gregarious, funny man. He's well likable, as advertised, if you've ever watched him on television and so forth. And afterwards, I had a couple minutes with him just to, you know, ask him some questions. And I asked him, the first question I asked him was the Stock Act. And he kind of did a huh. I said the Insider Trading Act about Congress and congressional staffers. Oh, yeah, yeah. He says, I remember that. I said, it was voted 98-2 in the Senate. It passed in the Senate, and you voted yes. And he goes, okay. And I said, were you aware at the time that you voted for that Stock Act that the records that were supposedly going to show the financial disclosure for the Congress and its staff are unavailable to the public unless they go to a basement, make an appointment, and go to a basement office in some building in D.C. and they're not on the internet, and you can't bring a camera, and you can't bring a recording device, you can't bring a pencil in the room to even review these documents. And he put his head down, and he went, no, I didn't know that, no. Then he looked up, he says, you want more transparency. I said, I'd just like to have the records on the internet, Senator. I think that would be something that would be laudable if we're going to actually have transparency. Is there something you can do about that? Can you address this, please? And he said, well, we have thousands of bills we deal with. There's a lot of stuff to deal with. What's your second question? And I said, well, there's the internet rumor is a muck. And the latest one of the day is that you're a dual U.S. Israeli citizen. Is that true? And he shook his head slowly. No. And then he leaned into me and he said, off the record, he said, that's a very anti-Semitic statement you just made. And I said, whoa, hold on a second, Senator. I raised my finger in the air and I go, no, hold on a second. That is not an anti-Semitic statement at all. It's a fair question, dual citizenship. And I said, this number two guy at the Federal Reserve under Janet Yellen is the former head of the Israeli Federal Reserve. And he's number two in this government. And he is a dual U.S. Israeli citizen. So it is not unlikely that there be a dual citizen in this government. That is not an anti-Semitic question that was asked. And he said, well, you have the point there. And then just shuffled off. So that was my encounter with Bernie Sanders. I thought it was worth sharing. Before the show, you looked up this information for me. I was correct in my recollection of the Federal Reserve number two. Am I right?
It does appear that way.
Yeah, Stanley Fisher, right?
Yes, Stanley Fisher. Yeah. At least according to my quick check on Wikipedia, he is the vice chairperson of the Federal Reserve System. He was governor of the Bank of Israel from May 1st, 2005 to June 30th, 2013. The first deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund, going back from 1994, he served until 2001. And he was the World Bank chief economist from 1998 to 1990. He's 71 years old. He was born in Mazubuka, Northern Rhodesia, which is now Zambia. Went to the London School of Economics and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And yes, you're correct. He is a dual citizen.
With Israel,
yes.
So, imagine that pedigree. He used to run the Bank of Israel. He used to be the Janet Yellen of Israel.
Yes,
the Bernanke of Israel in his day. So, I think that Mr. Sanders, I think any time the term Israel comes up and anything is questioned about it, maybe his gut reaction is to throw the anti-Semite card down. Who knows? But I didn't, on its face, it's not an anti-Semitic question. I was kind of taken aback that he took that stance. I was like, wow, okay,
It's really interesting when you ask somebody a question and they respond with a completely different statement. Now, just a normal, simple question like, are you a dual citizen? There's nothing inherently wrong with being a dual citizen until somebody answers the question that would be a racist remark.
Wow.
That speaks volumes about his mindset of where he's at.
Yes, it does. I think it does. That's why I'm sharing it.
Absolutely.
And he says off the record to me. Really? Bernie, this show is called For the Record. We were just, you're sitting in a studio called For the Record.
Any chance that there was an open mic that caught that?
Not close enough where he leaned in and said it very low to me. The Jim Needleman, the anchor, was standing right there. He came right up and wanted to hear what we were talking about. So, I'll put a link in the show notes at agenda31.org to the show. It'll air tomorrow morning on Channel 4. So just, more self-promotion of myself on television for you guys to enjoy.
Well, we do enjoy Todd.
Yeah. I tell you, it is.
If anybody gets the chance, I've seen you multiple times, and it is never boring to watch you disrupt the thought patterns of the average politician.
That's what we try to do. Exactly. It's shake it up a little bit and get something out there that's not your typical soundbite. And I'll work in some memes that we talk about here. I'll work them in. And of course, I broached the topic of the with the station manager and the anchor during before filming. Can we talk about some local issues, you know, like the emergency management agency and how it hasn't been formed properly for 14 years and bonded the taxpayers to, into debt under the auspices of Homeland Security? And they're like, yeah, we should probably send me an email about that, Todd. So I need to follow up, and that's what I will do. Bernie, you know, he's a avowed socialist, out loud, you know, he's got an estate tax thing he wants to promote, and it's going to increase the estate tax to, I think, like 90% or something like that for those that are in the top 0.25 percentile of wealth. When a wealth transfers, there's like 500 families that have an estate of $1 billion or more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting that he's, you know, it's easy to target that billionaire class, as he used it, his term billionaire class. But when you look in the details of his bill that he proposes, it doesn't give any relief to anybody underneath them. All of those taxes stay in.
Yes.
You know, the small, you know, Midwest farmer who inherits the farm from grandpa or dad is still going to have to pay the death tax. So it's really not any relief. You know, he talks about the middle class all the time, and the middle class needs relief. And he's not, he's just, you know, he's just, you know, demagoguing against the billionaire class. And, anyway, you'll see, we'd get into that discussion on the show with, and it's the anchor tries to pigeonhole that more, there's more Republican billionaires than Democrat billionaires. And I'm like, no. I think we need to check the stats on that one. So I will share with you though, if Hillary comes to town and I'm invited to be there, I will not be in attendance. I am not getting near that dynasty.
I was going to say, I think that's probably a good idea. I don't think that, as much as she's incorrect, I just don't think Hillary is going to view you as a positive resource to her election campaign.
No, there's no benefit for me being in the room asking any questions in that situation. Right. No.
Yeah, you're not going to get an answer, yeah. And you may end up with an obituary.
Yeah, it's not good.
In the near future.
Put it this way, there was no security entourage around Bernie. He just came and go freely. You know, came and went freely, just like Ron Paul when Ron Paul was in town.
Yeah,
I met Ron Paul numerous times, and he's always just, you know, just very calm. I think he did have a bodyguard, one guy, you know, Ron Paul, but he didn't have the Secret Service behind him. That's for sure.
He went and got the coffee.
Yeah. So recently, I came upon somebody sent me an essay about from Bastiat, Frederick Bastiat. You familiar with Frederick Bastiat?
I am not.
Oh, you need to search engine Bastiat. He wrote a little treatise called, I believe it's called, The Law.
And he's a French. Did you say his name is Nick Bastiat?
Frederick Bastiat. And let me pull this up here. I should be a little more prepared. I apologize. A French philosopher. And he wrote a piece. He lived from 1801 to 1850. And among other things, he wrote a piece called What is Seen and What is Not Seen, The Broken Window. And this is a really interesting little parable here, if you will. I'm just going to go ahead and read it because I think it's a good place to riff off of here. That which is seen and that which is not seen is the essay by Frederick Bastiat, written in 1850, I guess the year he died. And I'll put a link in the show notes to it. It's bastiat.org is a website that has his translations of his works from various sources. This translation is sourced from the fee.org location, and that is a, what is it they call the... They are the Foundation for Economic Education, which is a really cool looking website and a lot of good information there. I just found it the other day during this research, fee.org. Anyway, they are the ones who translated this. So this is the source of translation. And it's called The Broken Window. Have you ever witnessed the anger of the good shopkeeper, James B., when his careless son happened to break a square of glass? If you have been present at such a scene, you will most assuredly bear witness to the fact that every one of the spectators, were there even 30 of them, by common consent, apparently offered the unfortunate owner this invariable consolation. Is it an ill wind that blows? Nobody good? Everybody must live, and what would become of the glaziers if panes of glass were never broken? Now, this form of condolence contains an entire theory, which is it will be well to show up in this simple case, seeing that it is precisely the same as that which unhappily regulates the greater part of our economical institutions. Suppose it costs 6 francs to repair the damage, and you say that the accident brings 6 francs to the glazier's trade, that it encourages that trade to the amount of 6 francs. I grant it. I have not a word to say against it. You reason justly. The glazier comes, performs his task, receives his 6 francs, rubs his hands, and in his heart blesses the careless child. All this is that which is seen. But if, on the other hand, you come to the conclusion, as is too often the case, that it is a good thing to break windows, that it causes money to circulate, and that the encouragement of industry, in general, will be the result of it, you will oblige me to call out, "Stop there! Your theory is confined to that which is seen. It takes no account of that which is not seen. It is not seen that as our shopkeeper has spent 6 francs upon one thing, he cannot spend them upon another. It is not seen that if he had not had a window to replace, he would perhaps have replaced his old shoes or added another book to his library. In short, he would have employed his 6 francs in some way, which this accident has prevented. Let us take a view of industry in general as affected by this circumstance. The window being broken, the glazier's trade is encouraged to the amount of 6 francs. This is that which is seen. If the window had not been broken, the shoemaker's trade, or some other, would have had been encouraged to the amount of 6 francs. This is that which is not seen. And if that which is not seen is taken in consideration because it is a negative fact, as well as that which is seen because it is a positive fact, it will be understood that neither industry in general nor the sum total of national labor is affected, whether windows are broken or not. Now let us consider James B. himself. In the former supposition, that of the window being broken, he spends 6 francs and has neither more nor less than he had before the enjoyment of a window. In the second, where we suppose the window not to have been broken, he would have spent 6 francs on shoes and would have had at the same time the enjoyment of a pair of shoes and of a window. That's the part I think that people miss right there, Corey. Now, yes. As James B. forms a part of society, we must come to the conclusion that taking it all together and making an estimate of its enjoyments and its labors, it has lost the value of the broken window. When we arrive at this unexpected conclusion, society loses the value of things which were uselessly destroyed, and we must assent to a maxim which will make the hair of protectionists stand on end. To break, to spoil, to waste is not to encourage national labor, or more briefly, destruction is not profit. What will you say, Monsieur Industriel? What will you say, disciples of good M.F. Chamans, who has calculated with so much precision how much trade would gain by the burning of Paris, from the number of houses it would be necessary to rebuild? I am sorry to disturb these ingenious calculations as far as their spirit has been introduced into our legislation, but I beg him to begin them again by taking to the account that which is not seen and placing alongside of that which is seen. The reader must take care to remember that there are not two persons only, but three concerned in the little scene which I have submitted to his attention. One of them, James B., represents the consumer reduced by an act of destruction, to one enjoyment instead of two. Another, under the title of the glazier, shows us the producer whose trade is encouraged by the accident. The third is the shoemaker or some other tradesman whose labor suffers proportionably by the same cause. It is this third person who is always kept in the shade and who, personating that which is not seen, is a necessary element of the problem. It is he who shows us how absurd it is to think we see a profit in an act of destruction. It is he who will soon teach us that it is not less absurd to see a profit in restriction, which is, after all, nothing else than a partial destruction. Therefore, if you will only go to the root of the arguments which are adduced in its favor, all you will find will be the paraphrase of this vulgar saying: what would become of the glaziers if nobody ever broke windows? That's fantastic. Frederick Bastiat, I think, worth checking out.
It reminds me of years ago in San Diego. I used to own a window tint business. And there was a glazier, a guy that owned a glass shop, that figured out if he drove around at night with a BB gun, he was going to be able to keep his people working. That was his defense in court to charges of vandalism.
Wow.
Well, yeah, he brought up the intention was to keep his people working.
That was his defense?
Well, that was part of his defense.
Wow. And how did it what was the result?
He was convicted. There was a few windows that that needed window tint replaced, and I mean, it even worked for me. At first, I thought, you know, kind of, I guess selfishly, but I replaced the tint on the same window about four times in the course of a year, which was very expensive to the shop owner. Because these nice, big, beautiful plate glass windows, every couple of months, somebody would come with a BB gun and knock them out. And, of course, this guy just happened to have that size glass on, you know, ready to install right away at a discount. And it was, you know, it was just him going around shooting windows.
Yeah. This applies to our geopolitical Hegelian foreign policy.
Yes.
You know,
our government is going around shooting windows.
That's right. Exactly. What comes to mind, you know, when you think about the military industrial complex. We've got to, you know, let's build all these armored vehicles, send them abroad, and then actually not use them and then destroy them.
Yes.
But that created jobs back here in America, purportedly. You know, and that's a good thing. Not so much. And so I encourage people to check out Bastiat. He's a fascinating thinker, author, statesman.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Check him out. Well, that led me to that website I talked about, the Foundation for Education, Economic Education. FEE.org.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you seen these guys before?
I have not, but I have an acronym to talk about that's close to this.
Go ahead.
No. Let's keep going with yours. I like this because actually one of the things that I'm clicking on here, I came to the Foundation for Economic Education, which is FEE.org, FEE.org, and they have dated May 27th. This was in the news out here. It was the LA unions are demanding exemption from the $15 minimum wage. Did you read anything about this?
No, not yet. I'm just clicking on it right now. Yeah.
So what happened was the LA, in their infinite wisdom, agreed to or began to implement a bill that a union representative put together that hikes the minimum wage to at least $15. But what the union guy forgot to do in his bill, and he admitted this yesterday, it was on the radio, he apologized, he said he's taking full responsibility for it, and his explanation, I should have had a clip for this. I'll find a clip and we can put it on the site. But his explanation for what he did wrong was that in every bill, the standard practice is to put this in. He just doesn't know how it didn't get in there. Now, what do you think that standard practice is? Now, the unions are fighting for a $15 minimum wage.
The standard practice in bills being submitted to the Congress?
To LA.
Oh.
These are LA unions when they're doing stuff. The standard practice is to exempt the union. So what the union does is the union has these bills come in that affect, you know, law within Los Angeles. And then they exempt themselves. And all of these bills are like pro-worker, everything else. Well, the guy screwed up and forgot to exempt the LA unions from this $15 minimum wage. Now, what that does is it means everybody but the unions have to be paid at least $15 an hour. But if you're a union member, you can take less than that. In fact, in some cases, you're even allowed to take less than the current minimum wage.
Wow.
Now think about what that does. That means all of your competitors have to pay, the competitors who are non-union have to pay $15 minimum wage. But if they hire a union worker, they can pay less than the current minimum wage. And so all the union members are upset that the bill they got passed, but it doesn't exempt them. So now they're, you know, it's like half a step away from rioting in the streets.
And once again, why do the unions want to be exempt again?
Well, it gives them, they don't say this. What they say is, you know, they want to provide greater choices. But the deal is they want to squash competition. They want to make it where anybody who hires a non-union person has to pay at least $15. But historically, the unions, and I didn't know this until the guy that authored the bill absolutely admitted it in his apology, and he was very contrite, and he seemed incredibly sincere to his union that he screwed up and that he didn't put in the bill what is standard practice. As he, his own words, it's standard practice. It's something they always do. He just thought it was automatic. Didn't realize that they actually had to craft it into the bill, that unions are exempt from whatever laws that they pass. And he wants the unions in LA to be exempt from the new $15 minimum wage hike. And what that does is that makes everybody, in order to get a job, if somebody only wants to pay $10 an hour, they have to hire somebody in the union. And of course, at $10 an hour, now this person in the union has to pay union dues. But you're not going to get a job at the minimum wage of $15 an hour because the business can hire somebody at the union for $10 an hour.
Oh, my.
You see what I'm saying?
Unintended consequences.
Yeah, well, oops, we forgot to make it rules for you and rules for us. Now it's rules for everybody. And, you know, the union is, they got people who are incredibly upset. These are the same people that were marching around in LA with signs saying fight for $15, vote for $15, fight for California, $15 an hour, you know, economic freedom, all of this stuff. But they only want that economic freedom for everybody else. They want for themselves that, hey, we want real market forces where we can, you know, we can have the option to receive less income.
Incredible. Wow. I've been looking for the clip while you've been talking. That's why I'm a little bit distracted. I can't. If I had the guy's name, I could find it.
You know, I forgot his name. It was on the radio yesterday. There was let's see if we can find thing. I will. Yeah. You know what? I'll work on this for a second.
Yeah,
and
no problem.
I'll have it for you.
Yeah, cool. And this fee site, FEE.org, Foundation for Economic Education, it's really good. It's got a piece about this very topic you're talking about in there. And they're the ones that translated that Bastiat from French into English. And there's been some other translations of that broken window that are more, how shall I put it, put into modern day lingo, translated even further. So it isn't as, you know, I don't know, lengthy, perhaps. Folks at FEE have a book, a free book that they publish, which I want to also put a link to everybody with, 99 Ways to Leave Leviathan is what it's called. And it's a free ebook. It comes down in a by Max Borders and Jeffrey Tucker, 99 Ways to Leave Leviathan. And looks fascinating. It's published out of Atlanta, Georgia, the Foundation for Economic Education. And let's see, published under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 international license, it says. So it's not really copyrighted. So they're sharing it freely. And there's an introduction that talks about the state management of society is not only contrary to human liberty, it's also unworkable. And goes into a little intro about a lot of the things we talk about. And then it starts with, you know, number one, and it's short little paragraphs. Rent That Room talks about Airbnb. This is pretty much a 99 disruptive things going on that disrupts the state and the statehood of cloak of benevolence. And there's some fascinating stuff in here. Yeah.
I wonder if the issue of mass distrust of government is in there.
Well, these are actual, like, things that go that you can do, like physical things.
Oh, got it.
You know, I'll just randomly, you know, enjoy pot legally. You know, is one. Another one in here is expatriation is in here. Startup cities, radicalization of media arts, farmers markets, private neighborhood security, camera phones. a lot of things we all know about that listen to this, you know, this podcast, and but sometimes you have to be reminded, like, oh yeah, that camera on my phone is pretty disruptive.
It is.
Maybe I should use it a little more often when I'm dealing with GovCo and hold them accountable. So I'll put a link to that at the show notes too. It's good.
All right, Mike Ed Brotherton Fuhrer. just texted that it's Mike Fuhrer that did that. And I've got the link where they discuss that on a local show here on the John and Ken show, which is a major broadcast out of Los Angeles. One of their reporters, Eric Leonard, explains how union shops get exemptions and so forth.
Cool. What show is that on?
It's called the John and Ken Show. It's on KFI AM 640, and I'll put a link on the Basecamp for us.
Okay.
Actually, I'm going to send it to you through Skype because I'm uploading stuff to Basecamp now.
Okay, cool. That works. And, all right.
We'll have this in moments, everybody. Bear with us. And
well, you know, while we're waiting, I have to adjust behavior on the show here. I don't know if I mentioned this to you before, but there's a drought in California. So per executive order from Governor Brown, we'll only be using dry humor from here on out.
Yes, you better... You better alter your behavior.
Want to do my part.
Yes, you are. And I have to hand type this in because I'm Skyping on one computer and playing back stuff on the other, my friend.
I can send it to you in a different method if you want.
I got it.
Okay.
Today on the 1, 3, 6, 3, 4, 7. This just makes for really boring.
Radio.
Well, while you're doing that, I ran across something the other day about MIT and Harvard reporting on a study about fluoride. But this dates all the way back to 2012. The neurotoxicity of fluoride. Are you aware of this?
Oh yeah. The FDA had the fluoride taken out of baby formula over it.
Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, they just straight up explain that it's a neurotoxin, it affects adults, and that somebody should test this stuff on prenatal, you know, unborn babies, and that it absolutely causes cognitive dissonance.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Causes cognitive dissonance? Now, that's the first time I've heard that. What the actual result of the poison toxin in infants' brains is that I've never heard that. Now that's worth documenting.
Let me pull up the.
That would be pretty
important information to share. Yeah, Harvard did a 7-year study on fluoride as well, Brotherton says, and that's true. And I believe that's the one. That also looked at the natural occurring fluoride in small villages in China and showed a decrease in IQ over a spectrum. And I've actually been in city council chambers in Davenport dealing with encouraging the city council to review their 60-year-old contract to put sodium fluoride in the water. Because we put hydrofluorosilic acid in the water. I'm just going on the very principle, like, what did the contract say and what are you doing? Forget all the politics behind whether you're pro-fluoride or anti-fluoride in the water supply. And that China study was brought up by one of the council person who was given talking points. You could clearly tell. He didn't even know that all this stuff existed until somebody handed him something to say. And he said, are we going to start taking our cues from China and how they operate? And everybody laughed and... You know, so that Harvard study was readily dismissed just because of the Chinese source, unfortunately.
Ah, yes. Well, the Harvard study refers to the cognitive development in children. A few other sites are reporting the term, and this is where I got it from, was that it creates a cognitive dissonance. as they report from the Harvard thing. Now, I've downloaded the PDF. I don't have time to read at the moment, but I'll look through it real quick. After the show, maybe we can find something else.
Yeah, excellent.
Here is, I'll send you, now if I send this through a different method of communication, does that work for you?
Yeah, that's fine. So
okay.
This is Eric Leonard explaining how union shops got exemption. We're going to go back to this LA topic here. Let's see if I can get this to work.
The BP Driver Rewards Program.
Of course,
now
we have to have a nice ad
you
first.
Yes.
As a guy who makes a living selling advertising, I can't, you know, throw too many stones, but we'll mute that while BP
Oh, they can handle it.
You know, here we go.
Stay connected with KFI News on the hour on the half and when it breaks. I'm Shannon Farron.
John and Ken Show, John Cobell and Ken Champeau, KFI AM 640.
But this is a fully loaded show today. Of course, we're going to have Hack of the Dumpster.
Oh, yikes.
Five.
This might be the whole show.
At six.
You know,
John's
it's,
gonna give
it's
some
that
thoughts
segment.
From the
what I'll do
bench.
Is I'll pull yeah. it down and get a copy of it for you.
So here we are at Agenda 31 doing pre-show production on the fly, everybody. We apologize, but there's only so many hours in the day and so many days in the week. And we are trying to keep frequent with our postings, and hopefully you'll find some of what we share useful in your effort to address what's your strategy to make a difference where you live. And hopefully you're also hearing us on the playback on the No Agenda Stream at noagendastream.com. This is Todd McGreevy and Corey Ibe, and it is May 30th, 2015, episode 33. We always like to give a shout out to the No Agenda team of Curry and Dvorak and their army of citizen slaves that support them. And they build themselves as the best podcast in the universe. So they have tall order to fill, and they do a damn good job. And check out noagendashow.com to get the latest No Agenda Show. And, you know, per usual, I've, you know, always hear things that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the No Agenda Show. And hopefully you're listening to us on the No Agenda Stream as well. Other stuff to cover here today, Corey. You sent me an article about Bitcoin recently. And
yes.
I know there's been some critics of Bitcoin. I think that if we look at the recent arrest of the guy who started the Silk Road, the recent conviction, I should say, of the guy who started the Silk Road website, which was a way for people to anonymously exchange Bitcoin as value for value in exchange for drugs. And
yes.
There was a couple hundred.
And other, it wasn't just drugs that was being sold on the Silk Road. It was, if I recall correctly, I think there was actually a couple of murder for hire cases that involved the Silk Road. There was lots of paraphernalia. And then, of course, there was just normal things that were sold that people just didn't want to deal with government on. They wanted to transact privately. But because there was considered to be absolute anonymity, both in the parties involved in the transaction as well as the anonymous nature of Bitcoin, drugs were, you know, a natural product to be sold on the Silk Road.
The guy's name is Ross Ulbricht, Ulbricht, Ross Ulbricht, and Wired magazine has a piece about it. And I happened to turn on the FM public radio station yesterday late afternoon as I was traveling from point A to B. And I've actually lately just turned it off. I just don't even listen to the radio anymore. I'm in the media business. I should be paying closer attention. I just can't do it anymore. It's just such nonsense at every turn. And I happen to tune in during the BBC segment of NPR, where we get to hear the Brits take on things. And they interviewed some people about this Silk Road. And he had this Wired guy on talking about it. He being this host at BBC, I can't remember his name, but very pompous guy. And it was brought up that the intention of the Silk Road was to actually reduce harm, reduce injury, in that it would take the drugs off the street, there'd be less gang violence, because it was peer-reviewed, it being the product. So if you were selling junk,
you got bad reviews, you know, and you wouldn't sell anymore. Nobody wanted to buy somebody that was, you know, putting trash out there.
Right.
Self kind of, you know, self-healing, self-protecting type environment, if you will. And then the host for BBC says, yeah, but he wanted to sell guns too, didn't he? And, you know, the Wired guy's like, well, yeah, those were on there as well. There was a whole discussion about gun sales and so forth and, you know, the self-defense. And the BBC guy just overrode him and was like, well, I think his ethos has proven incorrect that it wasn't, he did have intention to harm people because he facilitated the sale of dangerous weapons. You know, and just, of course, just blew past the whole Second Amendment discussion and self-defense and just nothing to see here, you know, just boom. And it was like, I just hit off. I'm done. I'm not going to give these people any more of my headspace. Just incredible.
It is incredible.
Just propagandist of the high. It's just out of hand. So this judge,
the propaganda is everywhere on every subject.
It is. Except on No Agenda Stream.
Well, that's true.
If you listen to No Agenda Stream, you're going to hear the non-propagandistic information. This judge, and also just think about this for a second. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, how disruptive, forget, you know, the cloak of benevolence. We don't want people to hurt themselves with illicit drugs, right? With heroin and cocaine and so forth. I mean, that's just such laughable posturing.
It's ridiculous.
It's over the top ridiculous posturing. And obviously that this is extremely disruptive to the big pharma cartels. He was sentenced to life in prison. Judge Catherine Forrest gave Ulbricht the most severe sentence possible beyond what even the prosecution had explicitly requested. The minimum that he could have served was 20 years. It's life without parole. And she says the stated purpose was to be beyond the law. In the world you created over time, democracy didn't exist. You were captain of the ship, the dread pirate Roberts, she told Ulbricht as she read the sentence, referring to his pseudonym as the Silk Road's leader. Silk Road's birth and presence asserted that its creator was better than the laws of this country. This is deeply troubling, terribly misguided, and very dangerous. Wow. So, laws are above individuals.
Well, it's... she must be right, because the laws that we've created here in the United States have served to incarcerate 25% of the world's prison population. Mm-hmm. I mean, who else is going to make the cheese for Whole Foods?
Oh, really?
You didn't hear about that?
No.
Oh, Whole Foods, it just came out. Whole Foods is paying people 25 cents an hour to make their ridiculously overpriced cheese from prison.
Okay, let's add that to the show links. We got to have that in there now. Oh my, Whole Foods. Goodness.
Gives a whole new term to the term government cheese.
Yeah. You're on a roll today, Corey. Wow. Oh,
let me pull it. It's all over the place. Let me find. Well, why don't we just use Fox News as a reference?
Yeah, they have an emotional statement from drug users who overdosed and died. You know, their parents of people who died from overdose, that their son would still be alive if he never created this website. Really? Oh, my. Incredible. And so then later I did turn on the radio again, and it was off of BBC, and it was back to American propaganda. And... that's why I think they had this Wired guy on the second time and not the first time. Anyway, this Wired author was on, and he went into some explanation. I have not fully investigated this, but apparently a Secret Service agent stole the password and username of one of the lieutenants that, you know, helped run this website, one of the webmasters, and logged in as this guy and stole, I don't know, like a couple hundred grand or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Out of this and impersonating this other guy. And this wasn't part of a sting. This was the Secret Service agent, you know, actually breaking the, you know, I don't know if you
want to call it. He just saw an opportunity.
Yeah. And websites are now killing people. That's right. And then there's some kind of, this guy Ulbricht purportedly tried to hire somebody to be a hitman to take out the guy he thought stole from him, which was really the Secret Service guy, but was his buddy. thought it was his buddy, but it was really the Secret Service guy. And then the hitman he hired wasn't really a hitman. He was an undercover DEA agent. I mean, as I'm hearing this, you know, on the radio, I'm thinking to myself, okay, this is a movie. Somebody's already signed the movie rights up for this. This is already coming. This is going to be a big freaking movie someday.
Yeah.
So look for the movie. You know, we should probably take bets on who'll star in it as Ulbricht on the Silk Road. That'll be forthcoming. Probably be like Tom Cruise or something like that. And they wanted to make an example to stop even more dark web market kingpins. No more dark web, Corey. No more dark web for you.
No dark web for you.
Yeah, you cannot.
You know what's going to happen, though. I mean, the technology is getting better and better. People are getting smarter and smarter, and nobody trusts government. I never have a conversation with anybody anymore, even in the mainstream, where they talk about the blessings of government. Government's just out of control.
The blessings. People that they worship government.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they still do oftentimes, but now they're complaining about it. You know, and there's a market there. There's a market for people to trade freely. And whether that's drugs or anything. I forget. What's the country down south, South America that, 10 years ago, they decriminalized all drugs?
Oh, actually,
is it Portugal?
Portugal.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I think is in Europe.
Oh. Thank you for
showing
that,
some of our ethnocentrism here in America, not knowing the full globe, the map.
Yeah. Well, it's had a great effect on their overall nation. They're treating it like a health issue, and you know, I think we could use some deregulation, and government could use some competition. If people want to live in the world that government creates, and have a masterful overlord, you're allowed to be a 14th Amendment citizen and participate in that. I also would propose that the people who don't think that that's the right way to go, and they would rather have the risk of purchasing from unregulated sources that are, you know, kept in business simply by producing a good product, I think Americans are free to do that. But they can't do both. And
no, they can't. They can't do both.
So can I go backwards a little bit to a new acronym that I learned in California?
Please.
This is out of, actually, this has its histories with Governor Schwarzenegger here. When he was in office, they passed an ordinance that allowed for, or passed a law that allowed for the government to charge a fee. And because it's a fee, it's not a tax. That means they can do anything they want with it. Fees are not considered something that is bound by any rule of law or semblance. The government can just make it up, and that's what the courts have ruled so far. So this fee that came about was a fee related to a permit for refiners to be able to produce gasoline in California. And the California state government has come up in its infinite wisdom with a special blend of gasoline that you can't get anywhere else in the world. So it's really expensive. And if anything goes wrong with the production facility, if there's an accident of some sort, all of a sudden gas prices they just hike through the roof. And this fee, no joke, is called the FUC fee. It's called fuel under cap. It's part of what they want to keep hidden as a cap and trade. Now, this started off some ridiculously small percentage per gallon, which when you think of the billions of gallons of gas that are sold, it's a lot of money. But here in California, our gas is like $4 a gallon right now. It's nearly $2 a gallon more than the average in the rest of the country. And that's not because of the cost of oil. It's this FUC fee is what they like to call it. It's called a FUC fee. And Governor Brown, according to the Lundberg letter, which there was a representative from Lundberg who gave an interview on the radio the other day, You can get it from lundbergsurvey.com. It's called Thanks to Global Warming, Heated Regulations, is what they refer to the letter, that Californians will be paying $13 a gallon or more because of this FOOC fee. And gas prices, what they do is they just charge whatever they want. They can charge as much as they want. When I say they, I'm referring to California, in this FOOC fee. And now Governor Brown is openly saying that, hey, we have to get people out of their cars, and is pushing for gas prices to reach $16 a gallon as quickly as possible. $6 a gallon by 2020.
Wow. Yeah, I found now the LundbergSurvey.com. I found the letter here. I'll put it up in the show notes.
People are insane.
Oh, you got to request the form. You got to sign up to get this letter. I'll have to check it out.
I think you even have to pay for it once you get it. I'm not sure, but
well, this what is the All right, I'm trying to find some of this stuff on the FOOC fee too.
The basis of this FOOC fee is just a way for them to charge a per gallon fee. And it started out, I think they said somewhere like a tenth of a cent or something like that. It was a tiny, tiny fee. The whole point was to make it gives them an argument when they're putting in these types of regulations that, come on, it's a tenth of a cent. Nobody cares. It's going to help with global warming, all of that. Well, now that FOOC fee is all the way up to north of 60 cents a gallon. And Governor Brown is talking about adding, you know, multiple dollars per gallon for this FOOC fee. On top of that, when you buy your gas, you have to pay sales tax on the amount that you pay for the FOOC fee.
Oh, my.
So you have, you know, 40, 50 cents a gallon. I think it's 63 cents a gallon now in the greater Los Angeles area that goes to different state taxes. That does not include the sales tax, which is nearly 10%. But they're adding this FOOC fee that you can't see. And it allows them to do articles that say, look, we haven't raised gas taxes in, you know, over a decade, since like 1998, there's been no new gas taxes. So we need to help with the roads and all of that, because all the money they get from the gas tax goes in people's damn retirement plans. They're not putting it in for the roads. The money just goes to the general fund, and Governor Brown can spend it any way he wants, which is never on roads, or, well, very rarely on roads. We're out here in California 65 years behind on our infrastructure. So now there's this huge emergency and people pushing for a new gas tax or increase the gas tax because they haven't raised the tax. But they got this FOOC fee that they say, oh, well, but that's not a tax.
Yeah, according to one article I'm looking at, the State Chamber of Commerce is suing over it on the basis of the program is an illegal tax.
They'll lose. Because this has been discussed over and over again. If you're in that system, you don't have, you're using government benefit. And if they don't charge a tax, they can charge anything they want for a fee, which they've done with the driver's license, you know, to be able to pay for all the, you know, the undocumented aliens, as they refer to them, the people who are here illegally, no form of naturalization. In order to pay for them to be able to get driver's licenses, which is mind-boggling to me that people aren't dragging politicians out nude, tar and feathering them, and, you know, hanging them from a tree by their toes, they are planning on raising the fee to get your driver's license from $30 to $100 to be able to pay for all of this.
I thought they already implemented that.
I guess it gets implemented. I'll go back and check it. They had set it up, and then they had to pull back on it, and now they're implementing it a little bit more quietly.
Well, this FOOC fee is really it's cap and trade.
It is cap and trade. That's exactly what it is.
And this article is saying, as goes California, so goes the rest of the nation. Don't believe for a second that Democrats around the country aren't looking with lust at what is happening in California. And, you know, Curry and Dvorak played a clip on No Agenda on Thursday where Obama stood before the Coast Guard graduating and said out loud that the greatest
threat to national security
was climate change, and that it was impacting our military's ability to respond, and it started wars in Syria. It's it being climate change is the reason that we have all these problems now. That it creates a circumstance where terrorism can foster. It being climate change. It being the weather.
Yes. So be very when the weather changes. You're
terrorist strike.
Right. Right. Well, and even if the terrorists don't strike, if the weather changes, you're a criminal.
Because you breathe carbon dioxide. You exhale it, I should say. And, you know, that coffee.
There is some good news out there, though.
There is? Oh, good.
I'm uploading it to Basecamp now, and we can either play the clips today if we've got time. But have you heard of the case of Baca, a murder conviction out here in Riverside 20-some-odd years ago?
Vaguely.
So he a guy was convicted of a murder for hire case, and he appealed his murder conviction, and he was prosecuted in the Riverside County Prosecutor's Office. And this is finally just recently, with not too long ago, made its way to the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. And it is by far the most entertaining court session I have ever heard. Now, court by nature in federal court, they're very calm and you know, you don't hear people yelling. But I've got a few clips that are going up to Basecamp now, so we can play them. It's a little slow, but there's a few clips up there. The first six of them are very short, kind of gives you an idea of how the court was handling the defense side, the person, the attorney who was represented the convicted Baca, as opposed to how they handled the state, which is a prosecutor from our good friend Ms. Harris, who has eyes on being a senator. How they deal with her and the court. I've never heard this before. I don't think it's ever happened. But the court says, hey, this is being videotaped and play it for your boss. And it's based on a Riverside County prosecutor lying and then getting on the stand and lying again. And the entire conviction is based on a jailhouse informant who was lying.
And when you say that, I've got the YouTube link you sent me, Johnny Baca, B-A-C-A, V, Daryl Adams, D-E-R-R-A-L, Adams, Daryl, spelled weird, like feral, like a feral cat. What, is Daryl the guy who lied?
You know, Daryl's not the guy who lied. The guy who lied is actually no longer practicing law. His law license is inactive. He could return to law. And I'll upload a screenshot. This to me, you just can't write this stuff. But his law license says that if you need to send him any mail, send it care of French Laundry.
Wow.
And literally, weird. You send your mail to a French Laundry in Riverside area or something like that.
Mm.
I've got a screenshot for it. But what's important about this is the Riverside County Prosecutor's Office lost its plausible deniability that they were not lying.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court, or I'm sorry, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is basically ordering the Attorney General to file charges against the people involved who committed perjury. And effectively granting Baca a new trial by saying, you do not want us to write an opinion.
Does Baca stay in jail?
I believe he does stay in jail, but getting a new trial, he's likely not going to go to jail. In fact, it's a three-panel court. I've got some great info on this. I was trying to get it all put together last night, but it was kind of slow as far as getting the video and everything together, the clips and stuff. But
well, let's go over it next show. We'll have it. You go ahead and post it after the later today. I think what happens when you're uploading to Basecamp, it's dragging on the Skype.
Oh, okay. Maybe what I should do is pause that then.
Yeah, if it's almost done, that's fine. You it's maybe synced. We're in good shape.
Okay.
Well.
Very encouraging that
that's good news.
It's great news because if you can show that You know, I mean, I dealt with, in my case in Irvine, just constant lying, corruption of the courts hiding documents, the courts, you know, in a civil trial, I'm required to sit in a criminal courtroom in front of a desk labeled defendant, you know, just all kinds of stuff. And once this got to a different jurisdiction, namely federal court, these judges made it absolutely clear that they have no interest in dealing with corruption. And they effectively ended, in my opinion, ended the careers of several in the prosecutor's office in Riverside, and have, you know, every prosecutor in the nation should watch this half-hour segment from the Ninth Circuit and make it very clear that if your opponent can get onto the record that you lied, then you're in a lot of trouble.
How did he get it on the record?
It's really fascinating. What the basis was that the jailhouse informant didn't receive any compensation for his testimony. In other words, the prosecutor got on the stand and was bolstering the character of the jailhouse informant, the snitch, and saying that, you know, he's just being a good citizen. He wants to help solve a murder. Is in essence what this prosecutor, who now receives his mail from the French Laundry, said. And other prosecutors were involved in it. And this was what was called a murder for hire scheme. That was the government's theory, that one person named, I forgot his name. I think his name was actually Todd. He hired Baca to kill his, I think it was his parents. And it was, in fact, both parents were murdered, and Baca may have had something to do with it. I have no idea. But what the government did was they pursued a murder for hire theory, and they got this jailhouse informant to testify while they told everybody on the jury that the jailhouse informant is only there for being a good citizen. Well, in a whole nother case, it was proven in that informant's own case, in that testimony, it was proven that he did receive compensation, and he was saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm supposed to get more time off because I testified, and even the judge talked about it and everything else. Well, then the Riverside County Prosecutor's Office fought tooth and nail to keep public record, court record, out of Baca's trial. And what Baca was trying to say is, look, they lied. The prosecutor lied, they lied. And the thing that's crazy is they had the guy who did the hiring. Now, Baca was supposed to be, in the government's theory, an assassin, mm-hmm. and that he would handle the killing of the parents and get money, and that the other gentleman who was part of this actually testified in the first court trial and denied that he was part of a murder for hire scheme. Well, the Riverside County Prosecutor's Office, it was just so convenient to be able to convict Baca that they continued with the murder for hire scheme, but they never, even though they had the guy who ostensibly, or according to the government's theory, the guy who actually did the hiring, you know, solicitation for murder, they have him, they let him go. And in this clip, the representative from the state says that, well, we might not be able to reach him anymore because he received $500,000. And could be in a country with no extradition.
Oh, my.
They never brought charges. They never investigated. They never did anything. The entire trial relied, well, 95, 98% of the trial relied upon this jailhouse informant's testimony that the prosecutor lied to bolster his credibility, and lied twice. And the three-judge panel even refers to this case being completely fabricated.
Yeah, there's a Judge Kaczynski supposedly commenting that there is an epidemic of prosecutorial misconduct abroad in the land, and only judges can put a stop to it.
And boy, they did a great job in this. I tell you, this one case bolsters my entire theory of, hey, just document what they're doing, show that they're being corrupt. And at some point, you're going to get to the level of somebody who doesn't want the stench of corruption getting on them. and Judge Kozinski, who is the presiding judge for that Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, he and the other two judges, they were not kind to the state, including just the little throwaway when they called the state. I mean, they refer to this guy. It's just fantastic court antics that really is a great tool. If you're dealing with people in court, like in fact, the case that you have out there with the illegally collecting taxes. People are lying about things to be able to conduct their business.
Yeah, they are.
Well, it sure appears that by the time you get to a federal court, if you can prove that they're lying to the court, they're not going to stand for it at that level. The state courts, they're complicit in it completely, at least here in California. I know the Orange County Superior Court is beyond repair. It just absolutely needs to be abolished and start over. There is no chance of justice in the state court. But at the federal court, I'm telling you, this is so encouraging to watch.
It is good. That's excellent.
It really is.
I was trying to play something else for us, but my computer decided to not work very well again. Did you hear about the Cleveland cop who pumped 15 shots into a windshield?
I did. Yes, he was acquitted.
Yeah, Michael Brelo, B-R-E-L-O, Cleveland police officer, stood in a car and shot the unarmed black occupants 15 times just after officers first riddled it with bullets. But a judge ruled Saturday that partly because Brelo reasonably believed he was in danger, he's not guilty of a crime. This is in Cahoga County. Judge decided that Brelo was not guilty of voluntary manslaughter and felonious assault in the 2012 deaths of Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams following a 22-mile car chase. Emotions among people upset the verdict ran high outside the Cleveland courtroom. Some held up signs, no justice, no peace. I don't trust police no more. No police, none, said the victim's brother. I can't recover from this. This verdict isn't real. This verdict is fake. A chase that began when a car driven by Russell backfired, a noise the officers mistakenly thought was caused by gunshots in Cleveland in November of 2012. It turned out neither Russell, 43, nor Williams, 30, were armed, but Russell led numerous police officers on a 22-mile chase, sometimes at speeds over 100 miles an hour, before ramming a police car in a middle school parking lot in East Cleveland. Brelo and 12 other officers fired more than 100 times in 8 seconds at the car, after which, according to prosecutors, the pair could no longer be a threat. But Brelo exited his car, got on top of Williams' car hood, and fired at least 15 shots downward through the windshield into the victims at close range as he stood on the hood of Mr. Russell's car. The judge spelled out his reasons for his decision. The officer's first round of gunfire was permissible because they had a reason to believe they and the public were at risk, in part because of other officers told them the pair had weapons, that one of them had fired because Russell led them on a chase for so long and because of the ramming. Brelo's second round was permissible because a reasonable police officer could decide that, even after the 100 shots, the threat might not have been over, in part because the pair might still have been moving. Evidence shows Brelo's gunfire caused at least one wound each to Russell and Williams that would have killed either of them, but they suffered other lethal wounds, probably from other officers' guns. Now, there's some logic for you. They might be alive even after 100 rounds, but then we found the rounds in them that were from his gun specifically that would have been kill shots, but they were probably dead already.
Yeah, there's a couple of takeaways from that. One, don't run from the police.
Yes.
You know, you're just giving them plausible deniability. And that if you have to spend the weekend in jail or something like that, it's much better to survive that and come out and, live to fight another day. The idea is to never give an officer permission according to their policy for use of force, that you just conduct yourself in a way that there's never an opportunity for them to use of force under policy, because they will. And I would bet after this Baca case that it wouldn't be very hard to find inconsistencies in the officers' reports. They lie, and get them into federal court and expose the lies.
I did not know that there was a 22-mile car chase at over 100 miles an hour prior to this. I did hear that the car backfired and it sounded like a gunshot, and that's what ensued the shooting. But yeah, leading cops on a chase like that, you're going to have some problems. That's not going to work.
Yeah,
that's not a prudent choice of action, and it's incredible that this judge would. You know, they still might be alive, so it's okay to get on the hood and fire 15 shots in there. Oh, and then we found that two of the shots that you fired would have killed them, but they were probably already dead. So you're not guilty.
Yeah. And this is a state court judge, right? I believe it was, if I remember that correctly, it was a state judge that decision came from.
Yeah, I think you're right. And in Cleveland, in 14, the DOJ report found that Cleveland had a pattern of the police force has a pattern of excessive force. I mean, it's amazing that the Cleveland isn't on fire, man. I'm telling you, it's really ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, Ed just came in. It is a state court.
Yeah.
Now, this is just something that kind of bugs me. You hear over and over again how they say that Agenda 21 is a non-binding agreement.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's non-binding. There's no enforcement or anything like that.
Right. They being the apologists for Agenda 21.
Correct. Yeah. Anybody in support of Agenda 21? I've been hammered many times by internet trolls that, you know, there's absolutely no enforcement action. There's nothing binding. It's just an agreement. And, you know, I sent a response to a post I saw online a couple days ago. Somebody talking about how the Agenda 21 conspiracy theorists are, you know, saying it's trying to take away rights and everything else. And what struck me funny about this was, first off, if you even mentioned anything about Agenda 21 in the late 90s, that there was such a thing, you were considered a conspiracy theorist. That the even in talking about the existence of it, you would be a conspiracy theorist. Well, now if you talk about it being something that is a danger to your rights, you're a conspiracy theorist. And the same meme over and over again is that it's a non-binding, you know, agreement, just simply agreement. Well, the thing is, the president, President Bush, obligated the United States by signing on to it. So obviously federal personnel would be required to follow Agenda 21.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Right. I mean, if the president agrees to it and you know, obligates the United States, at the very minimum, all federal personnel would have to, they would have no choice. They are absolutely under the terms of Agenda 21. And so I brought up Title 5, Section 552A, Paragraph 13, that anybody in the United States of America who participates in a retirement plan is considered federal personnel, and that federal personnel obviously don't have a choice. They have to follow Agenda 21. It's binding on them, and that would be anybody who participates in Social Security. So I put this up, and of course, my comments were deleted, and I was blocked from ever participating in that conversation again.
Was this on Facebook?
No, this was on another. I'll get the link for you later in the shows. Just okay. A
different forum
from a forum. It's actually on my Facebook. The comment that I made, and I'll because I posted it where it put a comment on their site and on my Facebook, and I've been absolutely banned. I can't get on the site. I mean, I can't comment anymore.
Wow. Is that
no answers, no response, just, oh, yeah, we just can't have that train of thought getting out there.
No, we can't have that train of thought at all getting out there. this is it was Mark Potok, actually, who was on C-SPAN, and we played that clip. I'll try and find it and resuscitate that. He's the spokeshole from the Southern Poverty Law Center that was brought onto C-SPAN to address the Agenda 21 deniers. You know, the Agenda 21 conspiracy folks. And he's the one, among others, that said, it's non-binding. You know, it's not even a law. It's not a rule. You know, it's just an idea. So I'll play that. I got to put that in my. We'll try and bring that up again on the show here. Agenda 21 is around you. If you have children in school, in the public schools, even in the private school system, you're dealing with Common Core. That's Agenda 21. If you are in a state where they have a FUC or a fuck tax, like they have in California on fuel, you're dealing with Agenda 21. If you're living in a area where there's restrictions on having chickens in your yard or on your private property to grow eggs and to have chickens, you're dealing with Agenda 21. If you're living in an area that has county commissioners wringing their hands over how they can have their own emissions standards in the county and have a tax on motorists in the county and have a new fee on motorists in the county that don't have their mufflers checked and so forth, you're dealing with Agenda 21. Now, yes, I don't want to live in a county where people are just spewing, you know, noxious fumes right out of the back of their car. We've all been behind such a car before. It's not good. So there's you know, I'm not a total anarchist, if you will.
Well, we don't need to turn over control of our daily lives to a UN entity in order to keep cars clean. There's one has nothing to do with the other. It's just they're hijacking freedom and the way of life by exploiting the desire to have a clean environment.
And if you don't think that UN and international edicts are entering into your county, just go check out your latest building code in the county and see if it doesn't refer to the National Governor's Council on Building Codes, which refers to the international set of building codes, which I would dare say that most of the supervisors in your county, if they had to abide by those rules for their building where they live, couldn't have built the house they currently live in. At least that's the way it is here in Scott County. So thank you for tuning in to Agenda 31, everybody, on this Saturday, May 30th. This is episode 33.
You know, I got one last thing. Can we do it
before
we wrap up? In Wisconsin, if a cop walks up to your window and your window's only partially rolled down and he starts tapping on it, you are allowed to drive away.
Really?
Yes. I just sent you the link to the decision.
Wow.
It was it's a recent case that just came out, just decided, and it was bitterly fought in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But basically, they came back that nobody could reasonably assume that they are being detained if an officer with no lights on his car, obviously. And the case was a cop pulled up behind a car, didn't have his lights on, went up and started tapping on the window and wanted him to roll down the window. And the courts came back and said, hey, nobody could reasonably assume that they're being detained just because a cop is tapping on your window. You can drive away.
But if the lights are on?
If the lights are on, that's different.
Okay. Fair enough. We'll have to take a look at that. I'll get that PDF up in the show links, Corey. Fascinating. We had a couple pieces of good news today. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to Agenda 31. Agenda31.org is the website. Subscribe there at the blog, and you'll get an update of when we have new podcasts being broadcast. Until then, what is your strategy to make a difference? Take care. Agenda31.org.